lunch on Friday, the 14th, yes, it is 14th, on, at lunch, late lunch on Friday the 14th for 69, Channel 1 over.
Continuation of the talk on traveling.
Continuation of the talk on traveling.
The language.
I know. This is what you left it out there. What to say?
Alright.
So you're the one that's going to listen to it. Oh well, she'd appreciate it.
Now let's see this.
Fourth. This continuation of the talk on the trip to Borth.
Stopping at Jane's.
And stopping at Jane's, all right. Right, that's about it.
Yeah, I'll go back. You're holding out on us, you see. You travel all over the place. So a lot of
after we'd gotten Snoopy,
yeah,
the Ford,
yeah,
and we decided we'd try it out, and we took off for Borth, which is 150 miles away, and considering that Ford, that was daring, it really was.
Was it? Daring?
Oh, yes. Oh, yes. Of course, we hadn't had any trouble with the Ford yet, but all you had to do was look at it to know it was falling apart, so. So we really took our life in our hands. Or at least whether we get back or not.
You had 35 pounds in that, both of you.
Yes, yeah. No, wait a minute. I had about 30 pounds in it. It only cost 35 pounds. Plus 5 pounds to the dealer. Plus 15 pounds insurance. Plus anything else, so. Expensive.
Yeah.
You and Jane?
We bought it together and shared the cost.
Yeah.
So we had about 25 pounds in it each.
Good
night. So I had that use of that other car for my 2 weeks holiday, so that made up for a lot.
What car is that?
That Ford Anglia. That I drove all during my holiday. That was loaned to me because he had said that he would find me a car.
Yes.
Before the before my holiday, and he didn't. So he loaned me this Anglia until he could find me a car.
Oh, really?
So I had my holiday, and then we bought this Ford. And he didn't even get a, well, we gave him 5 pounds, but he said he didn't get a commission out of selling the car. It wasn't one that he had bought and was selling for a profit. It was one he was selling for a friend or something like that. And he didn't want to sell it to us at all. We wanted it.
But I don't know where Boris is. In Wales?
Yeah, it's on the, West Coast, not on. It's you just go straight across, and you go through some beautiful country. And that day we went was just the sort of day to go. When it wasn't hot and it wasn't cool, and just to be out, just driving, even just to be out on the road, was enough. And we stopped at Jane's. It was early in the morning. It was 7:30 when we got to Jane's. And got the pigs across the road. And Mrs. Wilde packed us up with water for the car. And a few things for lunch. Bottles of wine. What was it? It was a homemade wine. I forget whether it was elderberry wine. Homemade elderberry wine. We had 2 bottles of that. And that's all she gave us, was the wine and a basket. And we drove till about, when we decided we needed a break, and we pulled into one of these little Welsh market towns and found a parking place, and everybody piled out of the car and we went to get lunch. And so we found a bakery, got some bread, and then we found some little shop and got some cold meats and cheese, and everybody just sort of got what they wanted, cheddar cheese or whatever type of cheese they wanted, and sandwich spread. And then we all realized that we didn't have a knife. So we had to find a store that had a knife. And we all trooped up the street, and there were four or five of us trooped up the street and paraded into this little shop and stood around and stared at all the stuff in this hardware shop and waited to get a knife. Now, I had done the same thing on my holiday. I'd had to buy a knife, and I had walked in and into this shop and said, "I want a table knife, please." And he had pulled open a drawer from heaven knows where and found me a knife. And that was in Wales, too. But in this little place, we said, "We want a knife." And he says, "Well, what sort do you want?" I said, "Well, we want a knife that we can spread things with." He says, "Oh, well, I don't know whether I've got one." And he says, "Come on, really." And there were knives, you know, the regular display of knives all around us. Most of them steak knives, sharp knives. And he went back in the storeroom, and he brought out a box of all the things that they couldn't sell. And he says, "Well, why don't you pick yourself out something from these? Because we can't sell these, and I'll just let you have it at cost price." Well, I think we finally ended up with a celery knife or something like that. I've forgotten exactly. And then we got out, and we headed on our way, and we hadn't gotten very far before one of those bottles of elderberry wine popped. And for the rest of the trip, we had that perfume of elderberry wine in the car. And heading through that, oh, it's beautiful country. That was a sort of a blue and gold day. Just everything just stood out. Not sharp, but just stood out. Could see everything. And we got down to Borth. And you don't even know until you get there that you're near the coast. And when I went to go on my holiday, you knew when you were getting toward the coast, but this around Borth, it just stays green, and the hills are all sort of wooded. Until all of a sudden you just come out, and there's this flat marsh and beach. And Borth lies sort of in a curve between two points. And you drive on these drive down this flat bit of road until you get turned down on across the flat to the actual beach. And it's a hard pebble beach. You know, those great round flat pebbles. And this little seacoast town just strung out along the beach. Doesn't go more than one street wide anywhere. It's just strung out down along the beach. And apparently it gets very, very crowded there on weekends, but when we were there, see, there was hardly anybody there. It was midweek, and it was early in the season, and it was just, and the water was good, And we spent the afternoon just lying in the sun and going into the water when we felt like it. And it was one day I know that we didn't talk about horses. It was one day I know when we really didn't talk about horses. Just lay there and waited for the sun to get low. Talked much at all. Ooh, that wine was good. Coming back. That sunset. And you couldn't see. You couldn't see it. Because we were heading the other direction, you know. And you couldn't really see a sunset. But you could see what it was doing to the country around you, the way the light was changing. We got to Jane's, back to Jane's, before dark, or just at dark. Of course, that means 10 o'clock at night.
Oh, yeah.
It was about 9:30, 10 when we got there. It was just getting dark. And Miss Wilder had a supper for us. Cold supper.
Oh,
really? Mm-hmm. See, she knew we'd be heading back. We'd already told her about what time we'd be back. And we didn't stay long. We just stayed, you know, eat and talk a little head on. And all the way back, it'd be the wildest night's driving I think I'll ever do, because Jane was determined to keep me awake. And so she decided she would order how I was going to drive. And she decided that the best way to do it would be in a British officer's manner. And so all the way back, I was to the lights were terrible on that car. You couldn't see more than 5 feet in front of you when the headlights were on. And she knew the road, and I didn't. But she had never driven at night. She had just gotten her license, and she hadn't, well, a year or so, but she hadn't driven much at night. And so she thought it would be better if I drove. But she was going to tell me what the road was like. And so she'd start off about 200 feet from where there'd be a curve. And she said, there's going to be a curve up here. Ready? Right? So we got her. Nicely done, girl. Nicely done. Very nice. Then she, it was really bad when she decided that she was going to yell, stop. She did. And there wasn't anything to stop for. And by that time, I knew she'd been carrying it on so long that I could tell when she was serious and when she wasn't. She kept that up all the way from her house to Stratford. All the way.
That's an hour?
Almost 2 hours of that sort of thing. 2 hours of that. But I didn't go to sleep. It was better than the radio. I don't think anybody else went to sleep either, for that matter.
And your car didn't fall apart.
Oh, no, it performed beautifully. We were so proud of it. And so pleased with it. And the miracle that it could actually do 45 to 50 miles an hour and stay there and not drop that.
Well, now where else did you go in that little car?
In that little car? Well, we didn't do any other long trips except my wild excursion to London and round. I think you've already heard that one.
The London?
Pick up my friend who was going to Tallinn. Go to London. By this time the car was falling apart. Literally, everything was falling apart. And I started out at 4 o'clock in the morning. And got to just out of Oxford on a damp, misty, foggy, lots and lots of fog morning. And the windshield wiper on my side of the car collapsed. Just died. And I couldn't fix it. So I drove on to London without a windshield wiper, just hoping I wouldn't, you know, have to go through too many lighted places, because I could see all right as long as there wasn't any light. But if there was light, it reflected on the drops of water on the windshield, and I couldn't see a thing. And I made it to, got to London, made really good time. Fog and everything else, I made, got there faster than he could any time driving during the day, when there was any traffic on the roads. And got lost. First thing. I was on the road out to Heathrow and was almost into Shepherd's Bush before I realized that I hadn't made the turn. Somewhere there was got to be a turn and I hadn't made it. And I had to go back about three times before I found this little foot square sign that said Heathrow Airport to the right. And I got out to Heathrow, waited for my friend, and her plane had been canceled, and all the passengers from it moved to a later flight. And when her flight got in, she was all... That was funny. When she got that, it was the first time after, you know, after the first being there and everything being strange, that I've just been so used to English life and being in England that it didn't seem strange to me anymore. I could still see it, but it didn't seem strange. It didn't feel strange to me. But then when she got there, it was just like I'd just arrived again. Even though I had seen these things and knew about them, they all felt strange to me again. It was the first time in all that time I'd been there. And from then, see, it was only about a week till I left. It was just like I'd just come. A feeling of being strange to the country. From then until I left, I think it was the fact that I was leaving. But she was so excited about everything. And she had a friend who was going to meet her. And she wanted to know if I could take her with me in the car. And I had said, I'd written and told her yes if they didn't have too much luggage. Well, they had heaps of luggage. I told her if she had only two suitcases. See, I came over with just two suitcases, one big and one little. Well, she came over with four. And so did her friend. Huge things. And not only that, but her friend came out to Heathrow and left her luggage at Paddington. So we had to go back into London, get her luggage from Paddington, take it by subway to the airline's place. And that was a trip and a half. And her luggage naturally had the handle broken off the biggest piece of it.
The three of you?
The three of us, yeah. Three pieces of luggage, one each. Or I think there were four, but two of them were small. Dragging that thing from Paddington Station to it was over two blocks, two long London blocks from Paddington Station to the BOAC terminal. Or it's Victoria Station to the BOAC terminal. And dragging those suitcases, literally dragging one of them. And she kept saying, well, don't you think we ought to get a cab? And I said, well, heck, it's hardly worth it. It's only, you know, a block, isn't it? That's what you said. You're the one that's looked around the corner. She'd say, yes, well, we can make it. Then we got around the corner. It was still two blocks off, you know. And I said, well, do you want to get a cab? She said, no, we'll make it. halfway there, she wanted to get a cab, and I didn't. And we finally, this chap asked us if he wanted, if you know, he was trying to earn money for drink. Wanted to know if we wanted a porter to take the thing up. And I, by that time, she'd just been in London 2 days. She was so tired, my friend's little friend. So I decided, oh, what the heck, and let him take the heavy one to the terminal for us. And I didn't know whether it was cruel or to let him take it or let her take it. I don't know which one of them was worse shape.
Well, now, Bob, what did you actually see off the, you know, what I call that manor house? You know, the country, that old tradition. You know what? Go ahead.
Please. I think, like I've said before, seemed to me to have the most of any family I met. Now, I didn't meet many families. The Tilks were certainly not. Now, the older Tilks themselves, their whole upbringing was pre-World War I. And if you let her talk, now she seemed to be, if you just watched her and the world she lived in now, very modern. If you let her talk and listen to her, then she could talk about her childhood. Her whole manner would change. She'd get a just sort of graciousness and relaxed manner that she didn't have when she was talking about other things.
Yeah.
And a delight. And the Christmases, you see, that all the family would be together. They'd have these big family gatherings at Christmas, and everyone would be together for the Christmas crackers and the Christmas pudding. And when Mr. Tilt was courting her, and the sort of the dances, and see these big dances and the balls and the teas and garden parties they would go to. And her father, you see, her father was mayor of Stratford. She was from her family was big family in Stratford. And her father was the mayor who dedicated the theater there and was the president of the board on the theater. Hmm. And she remembered the place before the theater was built, when it was nothing but the canal went through there, and there was an old, she said it was just an ugly old mill over on one side of the river. And nothing on the theater. Well, there was a warehouse or something where the theater is now. And they tore all that down and built this theater there and put in all the park and the landscaping. And we missed a season at Stratford. They always go to something. Not all the productions, but at least two or three of them every season.
You can see it pretty well then through her eyes. Some of the life before World War One.
Some of it. Oh, it's difficult. We used to talk about the pride in workmanship. This is one thing she was firmly convinced was just missing in modern English life. And they had this coach that was somebody had brought in to Stratford. They were giving, it was supposed to be coach rides to one of the little villages outside Stratford and back on the old coach route. And the horses were badly matched, and the coaches were poorly kept, and the harness was not good and was not kept well. And there was no cruelty in it, except the horses were hard worked, but that's not cruel. They weren't being injured or anything like this. Not like they were being worked with harness sores or anything like that. But she was so upset. She said she could remember the last coach in Stratford. And the man who kept it, she knew his name, I don't. And she says everybody used to go out and stand at the doors when the coach went by. When he went by with his coach, they'd just come and stand at the doors, all the tradesmen and the butchers and the so forth, to watch him go by. And his horses were matched perfectly, and his harness, every piece of metal on it gleamed, and the leather was polished, and it was a sight worth seeing. And everybody knew him, and everybody knew the horses.
Now that's quite a glimpse through her eyes. How do you get those two cells, your two cells, together, that glimpse, and then struggling with those trunks along that street? That's ridiculous and it's sublime. Why didn't you just stay in Miss Tilt's world?
And she wasn't in it anymore.
Nothing at all?
And it was gone. The house they were raised in was gone. Well, her sister was married and lived in Stratford, but the last sort of touches.
Well, there's bound to be some carryover in their little academy out there. Well, after all, they still lived with horses.
Yes, they still lived with horses. Still that pride and the consideration of the animals they worked with, whether it was their dogs or their cows or their horses. That amazement. Mrs. Tilt's voice when she would come up and we would get our stuff ready to take down for lunch. And she'd say, "I do manage, don't I? I think I managed pretty well." And she always seemed so surprised that she could manage. Because she was practically by herself, really. that side of, as far as the domestic care of the house went. And all the business of the place. Because she was the accountant and the banker and everything.
Maybe that's why she's so hard to get along with.
Well, I know it was. But we didn't know that at first.
She created, she still created a little world for herself out there. And let you all share it. It wasn't reality or the present. And if you would be teach, you know, she figured maybe you could create your own little niche in the world. Trainers couldn't do. Well, maybe that's the vision of that little academy up in the hill, up at Dendale Springs. Maybe that's. You think you can avoid reality up there?
But avoiding reality is what I want to do, exactly. Be able to change your reality a bit.
Barbara, tell Faye about Trudy.
Trudy.
Now, Faye, let me tell you. You see, this girl is more interesting than one of the horses. And I think Barbara knows more about her than she does those horses. Trudy, little Dutch girl.
I've never heard about her.
Well, Trudy was one of the girls that that started out her course the same time I did. She was she has lived everywhere in the world, just about. And this, she's struck me as being, her parents are grooming her to be the wife of a diplomat. She's got this tremendous ability, for one thing, to fit into any type of society. Anybody she's with, she fits. And she never draws on one side of her life in the wrong place. If she's with a group of people who are decidedly hippie in tendency, she never mentions her Swiss life in Switzerland or Belgium English schools. And she just talks about the records and the music and the people she's known that they would understand. And if she was talking with me alone, away from the rest of the group, we'd talk about classical music or books or something like that. But she could always just draw on something to talk to everybody. She lived in she was born in Holland, but she only lived there a few years before they moved to South Africa. And she went to an English school in South Africa and rowed at the polo club. But her adventures at the polo club were enough to turn your hair on end. They'd go out riding in the bush, and she couldn't have been more than, I think she was 8 or 9, I think. She said she was, when she would be out and riding in the bush with a group of people, and she said you never could tell what was going to come around the next corner. They got chased by natives when they just, you know, they'd go and be in the wrong part of the bush, and they would get chased out, and one time they lost a horse in quicksand and nearly lost the rider. Completely.
And she was 9?
And she was 9 or 10. And her horse was, she had a horse of her own. And, she saw it killed. It was, I forget what it was. All these things, so many things like that happened to her, and yet they never, seemed to change her attitude, the way she could meet things. Maybe they just strengthened her, I don't know, toughened her. And she would, her parents moved to Thailand. And before she had, came to us, she was sent to a Swiss school to perfect her French. And her tales of her Swiss school were nothing to do with French.
Oh, really?
No, not to do with French. It was very strict. It was a very strict girls' school with a student, about 20 students. And the girls had a strict curfew and all this sort of thing. And they had, could only speak French. And they were lived, while they were in the house, they lived and studied French. They had to speak French, and they studied French literature and all this sort of thing. And then for recreation, they could go skiing or riding or sledding. And they used to go sledding in the moonlight, you know, and this sort of thing. But she didn't go sledding in the moonlight when she was on with the approval of that school. They would sneak out. They had to be in bed, I don't know what time. But as soon as they were sure that the mistress was asleep, they would go out and down the drain pipe. And that's when she went sledding in the moonlight.
So now that's what Mrs. Silk had to put, Tilk had to put up with.
Yeah, somebody's experience to Trudy getting by and thinking up things to tell and not thinking twice about doing it either. And then she came to us. She had told her parents that she wanted to teach riding, and that she was just that interested in horses. And somehow I get the feeling that actually her parents thought, well, I don't know what we're going to do with her this year, and it's horsemanship is an excellent thing for a young lady to know, so we'll let her go. And they found something else for her to do when she came out. She was sent for 6 weeks in a Flemish nunnery to learn Spanish. Because they have a home in Spain. Her Spanish isn't good enough. Now, I have a feeling her Spanish would do me fine. But her Spanish isn't good enough, so she has to go for 6 weeks to this nunnery to just spend. She said what they do is they lock you up in a cubicle and with the tapes, and you aren't allowed out until you know Spanish. They brainwash it. This is just about the way she put it, into knowing Spanish. And,
I'm supposed to live a normal human life, are you?
No! What's normal human life? She wouldn't know it if she ever ran across it. But and yet she's so terribly natural about the whole thing. You see, it's all, everything seems to come so easily to her. And we were at dinner one day, and there was this little Flemish girl who was over on holiday, and Judy, being what she is, loved to brag on Trudy. Judy was the younger Tilt daughter, and she loved to brag on Trudy, to brag on how much she had traveled, to brag on how much she knew, and on the sort of position that she was from. And she'd been doing this to this little Flemish girl. She said, "Now you ought to know Trudy. Well, her she's been to every country in the world." And the little girl's big eyes turns to Trudy, and she says, Have you really been to all these countries? And Trudy says, not many. A Trudy has been to just about every country in the world. And yet she could say, not many, and mean it. Mm-hmm. Because her idea of having been to a country was different from Judy's or this little girl's. And if you ask her which countries she had been to, and seriously meant, she would have said Switzerland, England, Africa, Thailand. But she's been to all these others, you see. She doesn't believe in marriage.
No.
She does. No, she doesn't believe in marriage. She believes it's a trap. And her brother, you see, was caught in it. Caught in it in the way he married and was within 2 years was divorced. And now he's just married again. And he had a hotel in Bangkok. And he was apparently always in some sort of trouble with her father. He was supposedly worked for her father because the hotel was owned by the company that her father worked for. And he was working for her father by managing this hotel. And they got in a big argument and he was fired. The son was fired. And Trudy would come home, would chat about her brother's latest exploit. It didn't worry her. But she swore that she would never get married. She did not believe in marriage as an institution. She felt that if two people wanted to live together, that was fine, but they should not trap themselves in marriage. So I think she's going to be married in about 3 years to a little Viet French boy who she's been going with for 3 years. And he gave her a beautiful ring when she was home. You know, when she went home on one of her holidays, she came back with this ring. And everybody said, oh, really, Trudy? What was all these speeches 2 months ago? But, see, he's the son of a diplomat, in a French diplomat in Bangkok.
He's French?
His father's French, and his mother's Vietnamese. And he spends his time alternately studying at a French university. And when he's home in Thailand doing espionage work for the U.S. Army in Viet Cong and working on the black market. And he is cute. He came to visit her while she was in England.
Oh, really?
And he is sweet. He really is.
Barbara, I didn't know you knew an international person.
Oh, well.
Like Trudy.
Right there amongst the horses, Faye.
Yes.
We'll work with horses.
No.
Not as a profession.
Miss Tilk, you're just wasting your time.
Well, what I saw, I'd almost say yes. As far as turning out professional instructors is concerned, if one out of the three of us that were on that year course, I'm probably the only one that'll be teaching any time in the future. And of all the people that were there, there are only about three that'll be teaching very long, if that many. Sarah Bowater will, because she's the sort that organizes. And as long as there's a pony club in existence, Sarah Bowater will be teaching.
Can you organize?
Only when forced to. Except for the times when she was home, which was frequently because she had visa problems. She had to go back every 6 months. And that meant twice while she was at Till. She had to go back to get her visa straightened out. That was a mess because she was she not believing in marriage. She realized that she was getting more and more entangled with Michelle, and she wasn't sure what she wanted to do about it. And that was the real reason she decided to come to England. It wasn't that she wanted to work with horses professionally. It was that she wanted to get away from Michelle to work things out. And then about 6 months after she got there, she started going out with an English boy. And they got on terribly well, just splendidly. And everybody was wondering, well, what, poor Michelle. This must, you know, she's worked things out all right. She's found somebody else. And then she went home and came back with that engagement ring. And everybody started figuring out how she was going to tell David for her. Now, everybody had it arranged how she was going to tell David and what she should tell David and how much she should tell David. And all David's friends knew about it and decided that she wasn't telling David enough. She told David everything. She told him everything there was to tell. But they all figured that she was holding back, that she was actually engaged. They all figured that she was going to hurt David terribly because she didn't drop him on the instant and stop going out with him. She continued to go out with him. And they were all, everybody, I never saw so much arranging on different people's parts for two people who had everything settled between them. They both knew exactly what they were doing, and everybody else was just up in the air and jumping around and getting excited. And I never saw two people calmer in my life. Because David was absolutely fabulous about it, and towards the whole thing. Mm. The English boy she was going out with.
He was what?
He was fabulous for her. He cared for her enough so that if they wanted to be friends, that was fine. And it didn't bother him. But Hillis, that amazed me. She's my age. Exactly. Well, I wanted to. I haven't got her address. And I wrote somebody who I knew had it, and they haven't answered me, so I don't have her address to keep in touch with her with. Well, suppose if I wrote to Mr. Bussink in Bangkok, Thailand, you should see her address. It's 9 lines long, and not one word of it intelligible to anyone except a Thai.
You'd have what? You're going to turn me in the first paper. In the morning?
You give me one, then I'll tell you whether I want to do yours or mine. The Emersonian Inquiry will sharpen the senses?
Faculties?
Of the person.
But you wouldn't allow that to Usher. You wouldn't even give him any faculties.
After supper, Friday the 14th of November, 69. After supper, Friday the 14th of November, 69. Okay. 14th of November. And it's after supper.
Camera over 645.
Channel 1 over. Around 6:45.
All this business, your little trips, you see, in your Anglia, and this report on the little Dutch girl, Trudy. Your visits up there with Jane in her manor house. Major who?
Pilkington.
Major Pilkington. Whose belly jumped up and down? Mr. Tiliki. Now, what does your family know about all those things?
There's some of that. And a lot of stuff I haven't talked about down here. They know about Snoopy. And they know about the trip to Boar. Or they know some of it. No, we talked a good bit before I came down. And I had all those pictures. And you don't just put a series of pictures up on a screen and just let them be there. You gotta talk about them. And so they know a Welsh sheep. And her youngster that was met just for Mom's benefit.
What's that?
A Welsh sheep, her youngster.
I
met on a road.
Yeah.
Or when I was walking around a little lake. Males. And old mama sheep and her lamb waddling down the road in front of me, and she didn't much bother to get out of the way when I went past, and I took a portrait because my mother likes sheep. And oh, let's see,
where'd your mother get a liking for sheep?
I don't know. I can just always remember in Kentucky when we used to go over to Lexington. You know, Donald and I were both having our teeth worked on.
Yeah.
And we used to go over to Lexington every week, 2 weeks, month, as it spread out. And she always liked spring because she loved to see the lambs out in the field.
Yeah.
And every time we'd go past a lamb, you see, our field with sheep in it, she'd get all excited and point out the sheep and the lambs.
Well, up there, Barbara, you just take a picture and show them, now this is the lamb I saw over there?
No. No more than I'd take a picture of that abbey in Scotland and say, this is an abbey in Scotland.
Mr. Tiliki, now, you didn't talk to them about him, or you say?
Lexington, I think I mentioned. I don't think I
mentioned.
Can't remember what kind of, you know.
You mean that's all they know, just the mention of these people? You don't talk about them?
Remember how much or how long?
Well, you do too. That's right, you're prevaricating. What's the longest you ever talked?
Well, I couldn't tell you.
You won't.
I talk constantly. When I say things that you want to know.
What's that?
I said I talk constantly. You want to know is when I say something and I couldn't tell you.
You don't talk constantly.
I chatter to my mother.
You do?
Yeah. See what my poor mother has to put up with?
You never talk connectedly?
Yeah.
Just chatter.
Good bit more about my holidays than I did about the tilts, being at the tilts.
You just love.
I'm glowering with you, darling.
You mean you just talked to them about that... about that petty little 2-week vacation of yours?
Well... Yes.
And you didn't tell them about being out to the jeans?
Yes.
That's all I know on your vacation.
I know. I said I just I talked more about that. Well, you couldn't ask them because now they've got the tapes. Remember which they were told on the tape, which they were told before.
Well, did you tell them as much as you wrote them in those letters?
I know, it's horrible. Or?
How much do you think you told them in those letters?
Not much. Next to nothing, I should say.
That little cramped handwriting on an airmail, see? With all these things going on over there. Now that's reported.
You think she cheated her parents?
Oh, she shortchanged him.
See, I figured I'd get home and have from September until January to report.
They'll hear more from you down here than they do up there. You write them now?
No. I got one letter from me. Maybe two. They're lucky. not much.
Air mail.
You could send them a postcard.
Well.
My Moo is the best reporter in our family, and you wouldn't think so.
Well, I think one of the biggest surprises my mother ever had was when Grandmom died, and Mom read for the first time her stepfather's letters that he had written when she was, you know, she was still a child. And she brought some of them down and read them to me. And they were good reporting. They were circumstantial. And she said she never even realized he saw these things. Nevertheless, could report, could write about them, yeah. Could put it down what he saw. And the one I remember she read to me was a description when he was in New York. And he was just mentioning things like the hotel porter and the rain outside and the just the things he saw as he went into his hotel and around his hotel. It was all very solid, pure experience, real, nothing sort of. Well, I don't know. Aside of him, she'd never realized he even existed.